Elijah had one goal: to seduce the devastatingly beautiful girlfriend of a known black arms dealer. What he doesn't know is she is on the hunt as well. In a time that fears the other, these two must work together to prevent disaster in an already dangerous world. I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. We shift into the paranormal today with another selection from Sourcebooks, Pretty Little Lion by Sulika Snyder. It is the second novel in her Third Shift series. And I found this while I was poking around the Sourcebooks Casablanca website looking for my next few reads. I was excited to see another shifter romance cross my path, so I clicked purchase and eagerly awaited its arrival at my door. I want to take a moment to talk about our author, Sulika Snyder. Looking at the bio on her website gives a bit of insight to what we might see inside her novel. She's a second-generation Indian-American immigrant, and she focuses on bringing diversity to her works. One romantic genre that I hadn't considered before is Bollywood, and it looks as though our author takes a great deal of inspiration from the bright and melodramatic film genre. Our novel today doesn't have a Bollywood theme exactly, but I might have to take a good look at some of her other works later on. But today, I want to dive right into Pretty Little Lion, and we will begin, as always, with our cover. It is a simple cover, all things considered, if perhaps a little derivative. But that might not be a bad thing. The title is surprisingly large, covering almost the entirety of the illustration without obstructing it. Behind, we see a dark-skinned shirtless man, and his face is partially out of view. Across his chest are claw marks, through which we can see the eyes of a lion. Like I said, it's straightforward, and it doesn't look like it was thrown together in 10 minutes. While it might not be the most original of ideas, it clearly conveys what we should expect. This is a thrilling romance, featuring a man who can turn into a lion. Personally, I do like it, especially considering that we have seen far worse as far as covers go. Our story will begin in New York City, in the VIP lounge of a hotel called the Manhattan Grand. We meet Meghna Saunders, influencer, celebrity party girl, and secret assassin. See, she has infiltrated the life of black arms dealer Mirko Aston, posing as his girlfriend. Her goal has been to learn what he knows, what he has, and then do away with him. We don't know her full background yet. The novel is putting us on a slow burn on that front. However, the looks she's been exchanging with one of Aston's new bodyguards are anything but low-key. The man was as beautiful as he was dangerous. A black t-shirt and jeans, meant to help him blend into the background like the rest of the hired security, clung to his rock-solid body like a lover. His skin, several shades darker than her own light brown, glowed with health and vitality. She doubted it came from any product, none of the high-end brand names she'd shilled as an influencer. The smooth curve of his shaved head begged for her hands to cradle it, to guide it down between her thighs. There's some good groundwork here in this passage. It's established that she has a strong and critical eye of her surroundings. The narration goes on to state that she can spot his shifter nature without speaking a word to him. We learn a bit about her background and how she sees our hero. Something that I found interesting are mentions of the world that we are working with here. This is what I would call an urban fantasy setting, as in, it's our world, just with some supernatural elements. A catalyst that our author decided to focus on was the year 2016, which at the time was a rough year in general. Socially speaking, depending on the circles that you ran in, you might have noticed a growing unease in marginalized communities, and then watched the unease grow into full-blown panic after the 2016 American presidential election. The world of Pretty Little Lion seems to have taken those fears and rearranged them inside of a world that was newly aware of supernatural powers living among the regular humans. Race is already a big deal in this novel. Most of our protagonists are people of color, and many of the antagonists are white. Then the author takes run-of-the-mill human racism and throws in the supernatural racism into the pot. I'm not sure if we can call it a metaphor, because on some level, metaphors require a degree of subtlety, and our setup here is all the subtlety as a cast iron pan to the face. We get something of a vague info dump as Megna surveys the party and her shifter watcher, glimpses of the world in which she lives. There's something called the Darkest Day, and following that event, whatever it was, everything people knew about the world had changed, and thus the world was thrown into chaos. The novel describes sickness and violence, but we don't get much more of a description from that. Because I haven't read the first novel, I don't know what the Darkest Day was, and it's a bit frustrating. I realize that we have run the risk of a full-blown info dump, but it's hard to regulate what I know about the world in the novel versus the world as I know it. There's a degree of realism that the novel relies on to situate us. As best as I can tell, it was business as usual right up until the Darkest Day, and then the cork was popped on the magic bottle. I want to know what happened in order to make shifters and djinns and vampires exist in the same world with Instagram and Twitter and bad politicians. If this were a straight urban fantasy novel, I wouldn't be so frustrated, because I would have been expected to pick up the first novel and establish myself there. However, this is a romance novel, and the deal with romance novels is usually a reader can, or at least should be able to, pick up any book from the series and not feel the loss of context. So while this opening scene would feel right at home in any romantic suspense novel, diving us right into the action, our lack of context is giving me some trouble. While Megna is contemplating jumping this guy's bones in order to get the focus off of her, our perspective turns to the man in question, Elijah Richter. He is at this party for one reason only, to act as a honeypot to attract Megna herself, and to get into Aston's organization in order to bring him down. It's obvious at this point that both of our heroes have no clue that they've targeted agents from different organizations. Megna approaches Elijah, who gives her the name Mac. After some banter, she will direct him to meet her in a certain closet somewhere in the house. Once in the closet, they get right to it, beginning with a life-changing kiss. Because she had no time for banter either. Just this, slipping her free hand around the back of his neck, pressing her open mouth to his with no teasing preambles. It was focused and fierce and went straight to his veins, like a drug that tasted of sweet honey and pepper and skin, the heat of her tongue finding his. It was the most passionately planned of assaults. More professional than any siege he'd ever laid. Lijah knew the exact minute he lost the upper hand, if he even had it to begin with. Certainly, we are dealing with spark of something, and I'm not really sure it's going to work here. Elijah has to constantly remind himself that it's just a job and she is only a means to an end, but he cannot keep his hands off her. Now we get into something that I've never seen before in any of these romance novels on the podcast, a perspective shift outside of our main pair. Now I have seen something similar to this employed in a couple of novels that we have not covered, specifically by Charisse Sinclair. We see through, let's say, a shaded lens of the designated villain, but those are only small snapshots designed to drive up our suspense. Here in Pretty Little Lion, our perspective shifts to an entire character, a vampire named Octavius, or Tavi for short. We see him among Aston's people, but it's not immediately obvious if he is on Aston's side exactly. I'll go ahead and say that Tavi's involvement has nothing to do with the romance of the story. It's only added for us to gain context on the story as it progresses. And here is where I would remove the book from the romance genre completely and just stick it to urban fantasy suspense. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the setup in the least. Multiple perspectives in a novel like this are a common narrative device, but this novel was advertised and presented as romance. It's under Sourcebook's romance imprint, and the back blurb has all the callings of a romance plot. While the multiple perspectives can help us gain context in this type of story, they unfortunately get in the way of why we are here, and that is to read and enjoy a romantic adventure. There's another perspective outside the main pair, but we'll get there. For the most part, if these little sidesteps have something to matter to the review, I'll mention it, but for our purposes, I'll just ignore them. Returning to Megna and Mac, Megna observes that all of the soups or the supernaturals at the party would be able to sniff out the fact that they were together, and that would be bad for the both of them. She suggests that they get a room somewhere else. Elijah dances around his words and certainly can tell when Megna dances back, but he's done his job well so far. Get close to Megna and get what he needs. I think he needs to get a tracker on her somewhere, I think. We catch up to Megna as she is sneaking away from the mistress hotel suite that Aston pays for, but she's covering her tracks anyway. The narration mentions things like drone surveillance, as though he wants to track folks who come and go from his parties. Megna is sure that he won't be able to follow her, but I'm not so certain. The way the tech is described in this book, I'm sure Aston would have no problem following any taxi that she chose to use, even if she had used cash. As she's driving away, we learn about her past, how she learned that she was something called an Apsara. She's not a shifter, but rather a mythological being from Hindu culture. A quick Wikipedia search tells me that they were known to be ethereally beautiful spirits, often seen as muses and guardians of fortunes, especially adept at dancing. In our story, she uses her unearthly beauty and grace in service to an organization called the Vidrohi, a network of assassins and spies, staffed almost entirely by women and also by non-binary individuals, if I am reading correctly. It's also a lonely job. Vidrohi agents have little to no contact with one another. Megna's own mother kept far apart from her until Meg turned 15, and that was when her mother returned to inform Meg of her birthright. Once inside her room at the other hotel, she uses a little scanner on her body to pick up any prints from her new fling, see if he had left anything behind, and she can send it off to the Vidrohi database for analyzation. Meanwhile, Elijah is itching to catch up with her, and it's all that he can do to stay put. Through his inner monologue, we get some of his backstory, from his time in the military to his work with Third Shift. Of particular note is a financial benefactor by the name of Jackson. He's rich and white, and the book wants you to know it. There's more than a few check-your-privilege moments with this character, thus adding to the overall theme of our novel. As Elijah finally breaks away from the party, we can see how uncomfortable he is with the idea of undercover work in general, especially when sex is involved. But from the looks of things, sex with Megna in service to his mission will not be an inconvenience. The next chapter will give us the second non-main perspective shift, and we meet Grace Maria Leung. She is a surgeon, works part-time in a hospital, and the rest of her time with Third Shift. She's involved with the very first poly groups that we've ever seen so far in the podcast. One partner is a pansexual vampire named Finn, and another is Nate, who is, as best as I can tell, a human lawyer. These three will run up against our other side character, Tavi. Sometimes the perspective matters to the story, sometimes it evolves their own romance, which is a little off-putting, but not because it's a poly group. I'm unhappy because, first of all, we were already trying to become invested in Elijah and Megna. This is their story. Now, it's not uncommon to see a B-plot line that has a romance between two other characters. She Dreamed of a Cowboy from all the way back in episode 2 has the best example of that. But we never shifted directly to their perspective, and they weren't really involved with the drama surrounding the mains. They acted only as supporting characters. Grace and Finn and Nate are not the featured focus, but now we still need to allot some emotional capital for their relationship. The other reason this bothers me is that this is the most interesting romantic setup we've seen so far. We've not yet seen a poly setup, and I wish we could have had a story where they weren't a side plot. But I also have to remember that the last time we had any mention of LGBTQ+ representation, it was a prince who had killed himself because everyone hated the fact that he was gay. So at least we're getting somewhere with representation. And it's also not a situation where the two guys are only into the one girl, and they don't know homo one another, so progress. Back to Meg and Elijah, they are going at it hard. They are both trying to separate the work from the sex in their heads, but it is apparently not going well. The sex, however... And given how little affection she held for her boyfriend, she'd probably pretend to feel betrayed for all of 5 seconds before she kissed him like she was kissing him now. Like it meant everything. Like they'd both die if she stopped. He didn't stop. He took it down a notch, making it perversely slow, keeping her at the brink of orgasm and staving off his own. Because she was beautiful like this, tangled with him, her throat bared and her hair spilling over them both. For the most part, the sex is pretty realistic, if not explicit. It's not as descriptive as some novels we've seen, but we aren't being hidden from the finer points of the deed. The narration talks about the bits, and it's more involved than just regular penetrative sex, so it gets a thumbs up from me. Unfortunately, their post-coital bliss is shattered pretty effectively when one of Aston's agents shows up and sees the two of them in bed. Elijah doesn't hesitate. He partially shifts, just his arm, and swings his giant lion paw at the intruder. The description of the carnage is surprisingly gruesome, but Elijah's surprised when he realizes that Megna is not fazed in the least. Meg explains what she is, partly what she's been doing, and expresses her displeasure at the ruination of her operation. She doesn't hide the fact that she knows exactly what Elijah is, and knows what he's been doing. And against her better judgment, despite everything she tells us about how she should just cut her losses, she sticks around with him. It might be an understatement to say that I am confused by her actions. They firmly established her character as a loner. Everything about her is untouchable, from her limited contact organization to her high celebrity status. And now she's going to go along with what Elijah wants because she liked the D? If anything, it's curiosity that keeps Megna around, but Elijah is already dead set on pulling Meg into their ranks at third shift. There's a lot of intermixed telling instead of showing moments in between her action. Much of it surrounds that setting that was established, how things are stressful and difficult for anyone who is not a white, heterosexual, cisgender human man. Elijah thinks of all the times he's faced discrimination or incorrect assumptions, but really it would be a more powerful statement if we saw these things happening, instead of the narration explaining to us that things are terrible. I don't disagree with the novel's assessment of how rough things get for anyone outside the white male majority, but it's a nuanced problem, and unfortunately I don't think we're getting a nuanced approach. But it can be a hard line to walk, and I'm certainly not going to discredit an author from a minority background speaking their piece on the state of their existence. The team discusses their next move, trying to balance how to cover Megna's involvement with the murdered agent and figuring out how they can use the vampire Tavi to their advantage. Looks like Tavi and Finn have some baggage, but I think this just adds to the potential drama for Finn and company before they seal the deal in their group romance. Again, great that we get this representation, but it's a distraction from the main show. The real problem, and why they're all here in the first place, is to get intel on a supposed bioweapon that Aston's been cooking up, so right now the race is on to get everything they need in place. Their leads have brought them to the name of a genetic researcher, a German fellow with a name that I have no hope of pronouncing, so I won't. So Elijah's next step is tracking down this guy, and for some reason Meg will be joining him instead of going back to her people. Elijah banters with her, and she has a strange moment of justifying associating sex with her work. I'm not sure what this is exactly. On the one hand, I can see the appeal of the femme fatale using her femininity and sexuality to get things done. On the other hand, it's very late 90s, early 2000s feminism. I don't think it's a metaphor for sex work, but I'm not sure why else this is a huge sticking point. Is Meg justifying herself to us, the readers? Justifying herself to Elijah? Or is it to herself? Is this meant to help conflate her need to engage in sex for her work, but her time spent with Elijah is unique somehow? Whatever it is, I'm a little tired of the constant reminders that she has sex as part of her job. And on top of that mess of a potential cliché, as she cleans up at a facility shower, we're going to get a very run-of-the-mill moment of self-reflection and denial. Now, water sluiced over her, urging her to linger under the hot spray, but she had no time to indulge. She just efficiently and ruthlessly scrubbed every trace of him from her skin. Every little bit of the past day and a half, the role she played, the hours she'd wasted neutralizing someone who didn't need to be neutralized, and the ridiculous assertion that she wouldn't fuck him again, which basically ensured that she would. That, too, was something she let the drain take away from her. Enough with the inner turmoil, now we finally get more purchase on why she became so invested in Aston in the first place. A colleague of hers, a djinn named Aisha, had gone missing for a year. Considering that Aisha had been doing the job for literal centuries, her sudden disappearance was, putting it lightly, a problem. Megna had made it her personal mission to figure out exactly what had happened. A lot of emphasis is put on how different the two organizations worked, Vidrohi versus Third Shift. The Vidrohi were cold, incommunicative, sexy, and lethal. Third Shift was more like a family arguing about the best way to carry out a mission over dinner, I guess. Reality is that the duality is played up constantly, possibly as a way to play up the differences between our mains. It's not haters to lovers, but there is a large chasm of personality to cross, namely how Meg's whole shtick hinges on her emotional blockade. No boyfriends. Ever. Except maybe as cover. As Elijah and Meg prepare to roll out, we get another glimpse of Elijah's shifting powers. He was bald when we started this story, but apparently can harness the power, rather than the shift, as says the book, to make his hair grow out long. In moments, he is sporting a mass of thick, long dreadlocks, in an imitation of a lion's mane. The scene is paired with the impression Elijah has on the people around him. It doesn't matter his background, he will always be seen as a black man, no matter what. Meg catches up with him, ready to hit the road, assuring him that, since he's with her, any checkpoints that they need to cross over won't cause them any problems, given her relationship to her powerful father. Their drive takes them to Connecticut, and Meg is pondering all the mistakes that she's been making, how she ended up throwing her lot in with Third Shift. Elijah tries to get information from her, or rather, tries small talk. He admits that the research team at Third Shift can't even find a whisper of what she really is, to which she replies, of course they wouldn't. Her public profile is surprisingly accurate, though. Famous and wealthy father, and absent mother, which plays into her cover as a spoiled influencer celebrity. Elijah questions how she hasn't been found out as a secret assassin, and she notes that once she's done with Aston, she's done with the high-profile cases, at least for a while, if only to avoid the bad press. They arrive at the facility that there is intel had marked for them and decided to infiltrate it via air ducts. Surprisingly, this works, and they manage to get themselves inside to get a good peek around. Thanks to technology, they should be able to move undetected for about an hour. I will say that there's a lot of gadgetry in this book. Very spy, much sneak. Before they get very far inside, though, they are attacked by something. Really, it's not an anything, but it's sure a monster of scientific making. Elijah makes himself useful by launching himself at the abomination, while Meg makes her way to the scientist behind it. They found the unpronounceable German evil genius, and using her magical Apsara powers, Meg charms him into spilling the beans. Powers that be have been trying to militarize shape-shifting abilities, but it looks like Mad Genius has finally done it, and he's helping Aston sell it to the highest bidder. Now it'll be a race to find the serum before that ever happens. Elijah's returned, naked of course, because he had to shift out of his clothing, and after seeing what Meg had done to the scientist, he is starting to worry.
"Did you do that to me? Charm me?" He spat the word like a curse. "Give me a little of the old Jedi mind trick."
Magna's skin burned with the implication. "The trick was you," she reminded. "Sent to my bed for your mission." He flinched. They were already experts at causing each other pain, just as they'd expertly given each other pleasure.
"Meg."
This bothers me, because it looks like Elijah's already thinking of them in couples terms, as though they have a long-established relationship instead of being a weekend hookup for spy shenanigans. It feels as though the author is trying to force their romance, and it's not working for me. They leave the lab, leaving the doctor and one other shifter they crossed alive but asleep, and as they drive away, Meg demands Elijah pull over somewhere. Not because she needed to collect herself. No, she's a hardened killer. This is just another mission. But our hardened killer, raised to be a singularly focused assassin, needed Elijah to pull over so she could sex him in the car. I was unaware that infiltrating a secret evil lab was an aphrodisiac, but here we are. After she gets what she needs, she can then focus on the problem at hand. How did they get the DNA needed for shifter experiments? She's concerned about her missing friend, afraid that they were able to process DNA from much more powerful beings. On their way back to headquarters, they get a call from base to stay low. Aston's quickly figured out that Meg is a liability, so he set fire to all of her personal properties. She's upset, not because of the loss of real estate, but because she's lost control over everything. Yeah, it's not been a good day for her. To make matters worse, they get a report that Meg's ex-husband, yes, she has one of those, was shot outside a nightclub. His injuries weren't lethal, but the message is clear. Aston can and will ruin her life. During part of her spiral, she noticed that Elijah has started calling her Meg, and he doesn't mince words on his explanation.
I'll stop if you hate it, if you prefer your full name, but I gotta tell you, love, Megna is too unreal and untouchable for the likes of me. Posh, gorgeous.
The bees inside her fell painfully silent, as if the only thing left of them was the cavernous space for his words to echo and the slow drip of honey along her bones. Oh, Elijah, I do not deserve a man like you. She's not. She's really not. I think you might be too unreal for me. The words tripped from her lips before she could second-guess them, and she twisted back into place, directing her eyes out the window as if that could erase what she confessed. I have to say, I'm not exactly a fan of this method of romantic establishment. It feels a little corny, something you'd hear in a line meant to lampoon the silly, over-the-top romance tropes when people want to make fun of romance. It also comes out of left field, but that's just how I feel. This novel, it's all over the place. It's not focused on one tone or theme, slingshotting us across the field of literary devices. I can't get invested in our couple. Is it because I am too busy trying to make sense of the setting? Am I working to keep the storyline straight in my head? Or is the constant POV shift preventing me from making a connection? I really can't be sure, but I do know that it's a lot. For the time being, Elijah and Meg are directed to lay low at a riding school, a posh stable where rich kids can learn to ride horses. It's owned by that resident rich white boy at third shift as a cover, and today it's their safe house. Except they've been made. Elijah wakes from a post-sex nap where he discovers Meg gone. He runs through the gambit of where she is to she's done a bunk to I smell blood, and when he walks outside to investigate further, he is immediately under fire. Messages from his team tell him that backup is on their way, so he only has to survive the moment. He catches up with Meg, but she's been shot. Thankfully, it's not fatal, and from the sound of things, it's barely an inconvenience for her, so long as she can get the bullets out. But for the moment, she's bleeding out, and Elijah has to work to protect both himself and his injured lady love. He transforms again, this time into a half-human, half-lion mix of a creature, so he can carry Meg to safety. Eventually, that backup arrives, and they are able to evacuate, delivering Meg right into third shift's med bay. Grace is a surgeon again, and she gets the bullets out, and Meg's healing powers start to kick in. At least I think that's what's happening. It's not fully established. All the supernatural beings have a very loose definition of what they are besides the vampires, because everybody knows what a vampire is. As she's healing, she's basically asleep, and Elijah's talking to her like she's in a coma, which really doesn't make a lot of sense. The whole show comes out for it, you know, come back to me and all that. The dialogue uses this moment to sort of reestablish what's going on, namely the auction that Aston will hold in order to sell the Insta-Shifter serum. I get the feeling Elijah had to say these things out loud because the narration has been, well, not terribly effective at keeping our attention onto ongoing events. I needed to be reminded, that's for sure. At the mention of the auction, Meg wakes up and it's all business. Thanks to supernatural healing, she is ready to go, knives flashing. But since there isn't a fight in the immediate vicinity, she decides to pull out the I'm going alone tactic, but Elijah's not going to have it. First they fight, and then they fuck. It's a very angry moment, and I hate to say that I'm just kind of waiting for them to be done with it so they can get back to work. Thankfully, I don't have to wait for long. They go to a debrief meeting where resident rich white boy Jackson throws a privilege tantrum about the fact that his writing school was compromised. I call it a privilege tantrum because that's how the book paints it. If something goes wrong, he loses his shit, apparently. Great quality in your bankroller. Thankfully, Grace puts him in his place, and he apologizes for being a big privileged dum-dum. Better than most white men, I suppose. Also present at this meeting is Tavi, Aston's pet vampire. Through those POV shifts with Grace and Finn, we watched them get Tavi alone, drugged, and dragged into third shift. Again, I haven't really discussed these moments because they distract from our main couple. Finn had used his past with Tavi to more or less get him to cooperate with third shift. His cooperation comes in the form of a phone call to Aston during the meeting, through which it's discovered that Aston never ordered the hit on the safe house. So who knows what happened there? After the call, it's decided, I think, that Elijah will be present for the auction, but I'm not sure how they want to do that. After the meeting, Elijah takes Meg up to his swanky apartment above Third Shift headquarters, so earned as he was a co-founder of the organization, and he and Meg have a talk about their relationship, about where it would go, and I'm sorry, I can't focus on this. For some reason, my eyes just slide over the words without taking in much of anything of substance. I'm just not feeling invested in the way that I should. Then their devices ping, and they've got some photos to look at. Photos of Chase, Meg's ex-husband. He's been kidnapped from his bed in the ICU and taken to God knows where. So, on top of everything else, we now have to deal with a search and rescue. And you would expect them to get their crap together immediately and go find the guy, right? Go straight into rescuing him since he's just a sweet, dumb himbo that married the wrong gal on accident. Right? No. Everyone at Third Shift decides that now is the perfect time for a potluck. It's not like they've got a potentially world-ending crisis on our hands and a hostage situation to boot. We definitely need to take some time for some family bonding, because that is what this is. This whole exercise is to show Meg that they're really just one big family, and boy howdy isn't it great to work for Third Shift. I'm just going to move on. Finally, they mobilize. One team, Meg and Elijah, go off to ruin the auction. Another team, Grace and Finn, are in charge of Chase's rescue. There's a brief pause before they head out to hammer in home the mommy issues Meg's been dealing with in the entire novel, something that I haven't mentioned because, frankly, it's just one more distraction in an already unfocused book. As it was her mother, called the General, who brought Meg into this life, she has been chewing on those mommy issues the whole time we've known her. Grace and Finn make their moves toward Chase, and so far, so good. Elijah's able to keep track of their progress while going forward with his. He and Meg infiltrate the building where the auction is being held, and they see a whole bunch of unsavory sorts. While hiding in a surveillance room, things get really morbid as they watch the auction room get pumped with a poison that kills humans. Once all the humans are dead, leaving only the supernatural standing, Aston's guards shoot the rest. Meg is surprisingly affected by this. As she was posing as Aston's girlfriend, she'd known and spent time with some of the folks that now lay dead. The narration says that they weren't all bad, certainly they didn't deserve getting gunned down or poisoned, but, you know, they're still hanging out with Aston, so I don't know where my sympathies should go. They figure out that Aston was making a run for it with the serum in the loading dock, and Meg's on the rampage. She catches up with Aston, dispatches his guards, and has a proper showdown. I suppose they learn that he's working with a bigger fish, and in exchange for securing the serum, he will be first in line for a dose. Of course, Meg kills him, but before she and Elijah can get the serum, Tavi rolls up behind them, drugs them, and then makes off with the goods. Except I'm not sure that it was Tavi, because when Meg comes to, she is face to face with her mother. Her mother warns her about a guy named Roman Hollister, who has been working behind the scenes for decades with money to do things, I guess, including getting Aston out of his way, and he might have done it using Third Shift via secret government funding. Meg brings this up when they get evacuated in a helicopter. When she mentions Roman's name, Jackson is thoroughly upset, since Roman is apparently his biological father and on one of the committees that Third Shift answers to. Great. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. There's some politicking here, but I've officially lost all focus. Meg does consider staying with Third Shift, though, despite everything. We've caught up with Tavi as he makes off with his spoils. I only mention this because his contact was the woman Meg was trying to locate. I genuinely have no idea what's happening here, with no idea with how this all fits. The only thing that I can pick out is that Tavi and Ayasha are involved together, possibly romantically. Our falling action finds Meg and Elijah coming to terms with the mission and themselves, both of them declaring their love for one another, and we come to the end of our novel. And I'm honestly disappointed. If this review feels like it was all over the place, it's because it is. I tried so hard to keep my focus, but the novel kept pulling me along like a pit bull out on a walk. We gotta sniff every leaf and pee on every tree and chase every squirrel. Like I said, it's a lot and it's everywhere. There's a few more things that I was frustrated with, but to get into the nitty-gritty, we'll hop along to Heather's final score. The cover will be our simplest stop, probably, and I'll give it a 3 out of 5. It's not horrible, but it's not particularly creative either. It's at least well executed, and it doesn't feel too try-hard. I really don't have much more to say on it than that. Drama will be a 3 out of 5. I wanted to rate this higher, since we're dealing with some pretty high stakes here. Secret missions, hostage situations, mad science, it had everything, along with our general romantic tension. But like everything else, it got mixed into the swirling mess that was our setting. It was peppered alongside the daily drama of living in a world that was hostile to minorities, but we weren't shown how those daily interactions caused harm to our protagonists. We were only told. There were probably a few loose threads that could have been cleaned up as far as drama goes, but for now, it really didn't drive home the thread of it all. Romance is a 2 out of 5. It's not bad enough for a 1, but just barely. Like drama, the narration grappled with telling versus showing, and the only reason I knew that our leads were struggling with their feelings for one another was because I was being told that they were struggling. We got cheesy lines and not much else. I didn't really see why they were attracted to one another, except maybe looks and sex. Otherwise, they didn't seem to like each other very much. It's also not helped that our narration kept skipping away to other romantic pairings. The time that was taken away to examine the poly setup between the two humans and the vampire should have been used to better establish Meg and Elijah's relation to one another. Spice will be a 3 out of 5. The sex was better than most Harlequins, but felt peppered in like it was the last thing added to an already full plate of flavors. That's not really a bad thing, but it added to the novel's tonal dissonance and added to the distractions. Worldbuilding is another 2 out of 5. I can see where the author was going with the setting that she laid out for us. I could understand her frustration when she described how things had changed for the worse ever since the 2016 election, but again, we're only told these things. We didn't see them. The only time it made an impact on the story was when they had to travel outside of New York, which apparently required papers, and that got waved away with Meg's connections. We were only told how bad things were, and I was left wishing that we could have actually seen these things. Finally, realism is a 2 out of 5 as well. I'm being generous here because a lot of concepts that were established were based on reality. Racism, white privilege, romantic tension. But the novel's approach to these topics were ham-fisted, in a screaming at the choir kind of way. Everyone who isn't a cisgendered heterosexual white man knows that cisgendered heterosexual white men suck. And for the few that don't get this, they won't be picking up this book anytime soon. There's something to be said about speculative fiction, using current events to imagine a different world, but the narration wasn't quite there. Another thing that brought the score down was some bewildering choices on the part of our characters, namely when Meg decided to go into the potluck instead of immediately running out to rescue her innocent ex-husband. Oh, and the fact that a ton of our characters were supernaturally gifted, so there's that. If I'm being fully honest with myself, I'm really more disappointed than anything else. Because I wanted to like this book. I love the paranormal and urban fantasy, and I was hoping to find something as delightful as my beloved Shifter's The Beau Monde, but alas, that didn't happen. I think the novel would be stronger if it didn't focus on the romance aspect as much. If the romance was dialed down and a few aspects were tweaked, I think we'd have a very enjoyable paranormal suspense novel. As it is, however, the novel doesn't know what it is, and we've lost out on what should have been an enjoyable read. I wanted to like this book, and I truly hope the author continues working hard, because I want more of these stories in the future. So for my final score, Pretty Little Lion will get 2 sharp hairpin knives out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an HBK production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.